session number 11510, reel 3.
Wing Commander Cox, reel 3.
Yes, both times I was shot down was on a Friday. Both times the 27th of the month, and both times were with an aircraft with the letter L. And never did I ever fly an aircraft on any other occasion on operations with a letter L on it. And also, both times it was not my aircraft, it was caused by me jumping into the nearest aircraft. So that's why I had an L on it, and but which is coincidental.
Was there much superstition amongst fighter pilots?
Oh yes, I think there were. Well, yes, I mean, I myself, I always flew with a St. Christopher, and I always, if it was my own aircraft, which of course you only get in a squadron when you've been with it a little while, but right throughout the war I always had my wife's name Pat on the side. But
stenciled on.
Painted on, yeah, stenciled on. But a lot of people, I mean, there were people with a little teddy bear, or, you know, the child's, perhaps if they've got children, or a scarf, a special scarf, perhaps their girlfriend or their wife had given them.
How long did it take you to recover from that incident?
Oh, only 48 hours.
As far as these fighter sweeps over France were concerned, did you prefer the Battle of Britain work or the fighter sweeps?
Oh no, I'd rather have the Battle of Britain, because I've gained my own personal opinion. I think the fighter sweeps were an awful waste of time and effort and that. But of course there were certain reasons for them. One thing was to keep the fighter squadrons, give them something to do. And we couldn't just sit in England waiting for the Luftwaffe to appear again. And especially, of course, once he invaded Russia, his raids were next to nothing. And another thing, we were told at the time that Churchill said that we got to be offensive, because this was the only offensive action being taken by the Allies, you might say. While Russia was getting badly mauled. It was the only, say Churchill felt it was the only sort of bit of help that we might be giving them, because it did tie some of the German fighter force down over France. The bombing raids, the bombers that we took for small formations, because we found the Luftwaffe wouldn't react just with fighters, only if we sent bombers they might do. But whether they did much damage, I think they may have unfortunately killed some rather innocent French people. I don't think really that the effort that we did put in, and I don't think it impressed the Russians all that amount, because I know it tied 100 to 150 German fighters, but I mean, compared with what they were throwing against the Russians, it was a small amount. I think that they did keep some of their best fighters. I mean, some of their more experienced squadrons were kept. But a lot of it was very boring, because, I mean, many a time you just went over and droned around and was a great height and came back home again. And of course, the other thing that I suppose one didn't like, one knew that if one did get shot down or anything, and that, and then you were taken prisoner, which unfortunately we lost quite a few good pilots that way. I mean, Douglas Bader himself ended up a prisoner. I mean, one or two of our squadron did. And
you became a pilot officer whilst you were with 19 Squadron.
Yes.
Did that make much difference to you?
Not really, no. It was a bit better living conditions in a way, and obviously one wanted a promotion, you'd obviously got to get a commission, because it was always my ambition to become a a squadron commander if possible, because actually going back in time, when I was at flying school on Harvard's, I remember being interviewed by the chief flying instructor, who went under the magnificent name of Squadron Leader Robin Hood, very experienced, who unfortunately was killed in the Battle of Britain. He was sent to 41 Squadron. And this was the time whether you were going on fighters or bombers, even though we were on being trained on Harvard's. So anyhow, I remember he was saying to me, well, you know, what have you got against going on bombers? I said, well, I don't want to go on a bomber. I said, I want to shoot down enemy aircraft. And I said, another thing, in a bomber, you're responsible for other people. Whereas if you're in a fighter, you're only responsible for yourself. So he said, oh, no. He said, no. He said, suppose you would become a squadron commander. He said, you'd be responsible for the other people in the squadron. And of course, being a very junior sergeant pilot, no thoughts had ever crossed my mind that I might rise to the rank of squadron commander, but that sowed a seed. That obviously he thought it was possible, which of course quite a few sergeant pilots ended up commanding squadrons.
When you were escorting bombers over France, were they mostly Blenheims or what?
Well, Blenheims in 41, in 42, when I was with 72 Fighter Squadron, the Americans were in the war by then, and then we were escorting Mitchells and Bostons. And the odd fortress, but of course we had to leave the fortresses because they were penetrating into Germany. We didn't have the range.
Can we go on to 72 Squadron now? And can you tell me how you came to be with them?
Well, I'd done my period of instruction. When I left 19 Squadron, I went to 57 Operational Training Unit at Harden in Cheshire, where you were teaching pilots who were, before they went to Squadron, what to do and what not to do. The instructors were all people who were on rest from a squadron, so we had experience. And after so many months there, you were sent back to a squadron, and what squadron was a matter of luck. And I was very pleased to be posted to Biggin Hill, because, I mean, that was one of the more active fighter bases of the time. And 72, actually, we're one of the crack squadrons in 11 Group.
Why were they so good?
Well, they'd always been a good squadron, been in the Battle of Britain. They'd always had good leaders. When I went there, we had a chap called Brian Kinkham, who was a very, very good leader, very aggressive. We had two flight commanders, one Australian and one Canadian. It was an aggressive squadron with a good record.
Did you find it much different from 19 Squadron?
Well, one thing, one was more experienced by then. You were on your second tour of ops, which meant you had a certain amount of respect was given you by the pilots who were obviously on their first. And of course, then you started very quickly being given the leadership of sections. I think it was a better spirit than 19. You see, 19, I mean, I know one of the ex-19 squadron pilots who lived near me in Lincolnshire. He got shot down over Dunkirk, and he ended up as an air vice marshal, commandant and that. And he was the one, actually, that put me first in a Spitfire and said, this is that and that's this. And he admitted to me, though he was an ex-Cranwell cadet, that 19 were a snobbish squadron. There was no doubt about it, they were. But, and sergeant pilots were sergeant pilots and officers were officers, there's no doubt about that. But you see, but the Air Force was changing. I think it was very well described in a book by Harold Balfour, who was Under Secretary of State for Air just before the war, I think. And he wrote about the Battle of Britain, and he said, fighter command squadrons at the start of the Battle of Britain, Fighter Command was really like a very exclusive flying club. And I think that was, describe it rather.
And what about the comparison between Biggin Hill and Duxford?
Oh, well, of course, Biggin Hill had suffered in the Battle of Britain, and it was near the centre of things, you know, and the... there were other there was Kenley nearby. We had an American squadron at Biggin with us. It was near the front line. I mean, even then, I mean, if you took off from Biggin, it was not, you had to watch yourself. You still get the odd marauding 109 if you flew towards the coast or anything. So you were, on the alert all the time. Because I think the other thing about being in 72, that we had then come up against the new German fighter, the Focke-Wulf 190. And we still got Spitfires. Of course, this made life rather hectic. And again, the 72 showed how good they were. I mean, they had hardly any casualties at all against the 190. But the wing commander, one called Jamie Rankin, unfortunately, is now dead. He had the brilliant idea that when we went over to the continent, we went over at 0 feet. We took off from Biggin Hill and flew as low as possible till we were within sight of the French coast, then climbed like hell, and with a bit of luck, we were above the 190s as they were taking off. And then the idea was with height advantage, one could cope with them. But once that was lost, their superiority started to bear fruit. And Jamie Rankin, he used to have a sign that when he felt that the initial advantage had gone, he used to shout over the radio, "Everybody out, everybody out." Which I made a comment once that beat the British Leyland strikers after the war, led by, what was his name, Red Robbie. Everybody out.
What exactly did he mean by everybody out?
We all dived for the deck and got back to the home.
So the idea of going out at 0 feet was to avoid the radar.
Yeah.
What do you remember about your first encounter with the 190?
Well, I didn't have an awful lot to do with them. I remember damaging one and that, but and diving and that, and there's no doubt about it that when they were above you. Or on the level, they had the speed and that, and you could only do it by, we were still a little more manoeuvrable, but the squadron were good. You see, even when we get perhaps caught by some, we had such a good flight commander, a chap called Hugo Armstrong. He could tell when, more or less gauge when the 190s were going to open fire, and we do a very quick turn into them and then press on for home, in a series of turns.
What kind of a chap was Brian Kinkham in those days?
Very aggressive. Didn't suffer fools, there's no doubt about it. And I remember falling foul of him once when I described a 190 that had been hit by one of the other 72 pilots. And they said, was it on fire? You see, and I said, well, it was very difficult, there was an awful lot of smoke. And Brian Kinkham said, and he said, the bloody thing was either on fire or it wasn't it? But as it was a little way off me, I said, well, I couldn't tell perfectly, I believe it did crash in the end though. I mean, and he was a very good squadron commander, and of course later on he became, I think, a group captain in that. I saw him not long ago. He's aged a bit, like a lot of us, but no. And I will say this thing I've always admired Brian Kinkham for. He won everything about us being heroes in the Battle of Britain, and on two occasions in which we've been asked to wear our medals on things, he hasn't. No, he just said, no. And he never would say how many he shot down. They reckon a lot. He just, I did some, so he was very offhand. He's credited with so many, but I think people with him in the Battle of Britain reckon he shot a lot more down than he ever claimed.
Are there any specific incidents from this period with 72 Squadron that you can recount that stick out in your mind?
Not really, no. Oh yes, there is one. There used to be some very good country clubs nearby, and we often used to go, if we were released, being summertime, we used to go out to these, and there were a fair bit to drink. I remember there was one occasion in which we were on from dawn, four of us, and we'd been out to this club, and I was feeling, might say, very much under the weather. And our job this fall was to go off the French coast at 0 feet parallel and look for German shipping and then report, which case the information we relayed to our MTBs or perhaps any light bombers. Anyway, I was the nearest one to the French coast and looking out to sea, and I suddenly saw this merchant ship, and I reported it to Red Leader. I said, "Red Leader, there's a merchant ship over at 9 o'clock. You always use the clock code for direction." And I said, "It's a hell of a lot of seagulls flying around it." And that's to me, you see, I was like this, sort of bleary-eyed. And the next moment, Red 3, Red 1 here. "Seagulls be buggered," he said, "they're Focke-Wulf 190s. So we sort of kept low on the water, and I was obtrusively got away. But I was quite convinced they were seagulls. So it showed that my drink of the night before had made me a little bleary-eyed.
What is this system of Red Leader and Red 1, Red 2 and so on? Can you explain it?
Yes. The squadron commander is you have sections. You have red, blue, green and yellow, which is four threes. Or if you're flying in fours, which we were later on, it's then red, green and blue. And the red is always the leading section, and obviously Red 1 is always the squadron commander. And Blue 1 would be the leader of the blue section, and Green or Yellow 1 would be the leader of that section. And the one on the, if you were flying in four line astern, it would be 1-2, red, 1-2-3-4. Or if you were flying in a Vic, the one on the right is red 3, and the one on the left is, sorry, one on the right is red 2, the one on the left is red 3. But when you're operating as a squadron, though, or as a wing, there, of course, is the actual squadron call sign, and we were called Feta Squadron.
Feta?
Feta, yes, F-E-T-T-E-R. And he would be Feta Leader. If he wanted to call the wing leader or another squadron, they say Feta Leader here. Or if he wanted to talk to the other people of the squadron. But when you were just a section of four, he wouldn't say Feta Leader, he'd say Red 1 here. It's only when you operate as a squadron that you're using the squadron sign.
You were transferred from Biggin Hill to Ayr, the squadron?
Yes.
Were you completely out of things there?
Yes. Well, actually, we were cooperating in the lowlands of Scotland, low-level attacks with, obviously make-believe, with the army, because we didn't know where we were going. Well, as it turned out, we went to Tunisia, and the First Army were practicing in the lowlands, so we ended up in Tunisia and found the First Army were there also. But at that time, we knew nothing. We didn't know where we were going.
How did you get out to Tunisia?
We were split up into merchant boats. There were nine of 72 on one and nine of 93 on another. They split them up on the convoy in case, obviously, if they got torpedoed, you didn't lose all your pilots. It took us a month, actually, to Gibraltar. But they did. Why they did that, they went round into a sort of dead dog legs, so that we all arrived at Gibraltar in preparation for the North African landings. Then our Spitfires were assembled there, and then we flew with long-range tanks to Algiers.
This would be November 42?
Yes, yes. And we were in Algiers for a few days doing patrols there, and then we moved up to Beaune, which is on the border of Algiers and Algeria and Tunisia. And then after a few days we went to Sukalaba. We were the most advanced squadron. And we from there we stayed at Sukalaba till January 43. Then we moved to Sukul Kemis, which is only a few miles up the road. It was in a valley.
Were you still equipped with Spitfire fives?
Yes, when we went out to North Africa, we had tropical fives, which were about 30 miles an hour slower than the fives we had in the UK, because they had a huge filter underneath for the sand. Not that there was any sand in Tunisia when we got there, it was all mud and rain, so we didn't need them. And of course the disadvantage we're at, that the Germans who arrived in Tunisia, they were operating from runways and they didn't have these filters, so we were up against them with, if you like, at a disadvantage, but we seemed to do all right though.
What kind of work did the squadron do in Tunisia?
Well, we're patrols over the army, because the Germans were attacking the First Army, any tanks and that, escorting light bombers or Hurricanes with bombs, later on escorting fortresses when the Americans arrived, and escorting American light bombers, and strafing. Actually, that was the most hectic time I had during the war, because from we started our operations at the end of November, and I left in May. I left in April, and I did 104 sorties, and then that includes 3 weeks in which we were off going back to get our Spit 9, so it was very intensive.
What type of targets were you strafing? Lorries?
Lorries, yes. Troop positions. Sometimes supply wagons or anything like that. Anything that moved on their side.
What incidents stick out in your mind from those days?
Well, I think the first one was on the... as I say, we were the first squadron at Sukalaba, and we'd only just landed, and a Messerschmitt 109 flew across, obviously having a look-see. And this was on the... I think it was on the Friday. And we went out on the Sunday morning, shot up some troop lorries, and we... In the afternoon, we were expecting another Spitfire squadron to arrive, 152. And we all lived in two big tents, which we got from the Foreign Legion. We slept with our sort of old feet together. And this one tent we used as a wash place, and I was shaving, actually. And I heard these aircraft, so I looked out, and out through cloud, these single-engine aircraft, they're all 152. Went back in, and next moment, the tent went up in flames. And anyway, they were fighter bombers, 109s and 190s, and they destroyed nearly all our Spitfires. The tent that I was in caught fire because there was a lot of petrol in ditches nearby, and they were hit. And of course, this was a cascade of flying, burning petrol. I remember running out, my uniform got somewhat burnt. And running for cover, then a bomb landed, and I had a splinter in my left hand. Nothing very much, but then in after that, the
when would that have been?
That was in the afternoon of the 22nd, this Sunday.
22nd of
November.
At Sukalaba.
Yeah. And then about we were sort of recovering from that. We decided to have something to eat, and the CO, Bobby Oxpring, myself were cooking an egg each, and all of a sudden some Stukas appeared with escort high over, and they bombed us. And old Bobby and I, we ran out into the open away from obviously where they were bombing, and threw ourselves flat, and both found that we'd still got our eggs in our spoons. So we always say we'd have won the championship of the world at egg spoon race. And then the third time, they strafed us about an hour later, and I remember throwing myself on top of old Bobby, and a cannon shell came, hit the earth and went underneath my foot and out the other side. So that was, I might say, a lucky escape. So it was a hectic afternoon, that.
How quickly did you get replacements for your Spitfires?
Only about a couple of days, but we got American Spitfires because the Americans had got Spitfires back in Morocco, and you know they were sort of back there. So we had these Spitfires arrived with American flags and Lord knows what on them to start with, and then we quickly got some you know new ones after that.
Were they any different from British Spitfires?
No.
Just the markings.
Yes.
Any other incidents in Tunisia you can recount?
Well, when we went back to in January to Gibraltar to get Spit 9s, which was the improved Spitfire, the supercharger and all that. And then, of course, we were taking escort to fortresses, bombing Bizerta and Tunisia. And for the first time, we managed to outclimb the 190s. On one occasion, I've been entering in my logbook at 37,000 feet, we were still climbing and leaving the 190s behind, which I think rather surprised them.
So, did you feel that the Spitfire 9 was superior to the Focke-Wulf 190?
Yes, it was, I think, slightly superior. Nothing much in it, because then they improved the 190, so. But the Spit, that was our first encounter. Well, first time I flew Spit 9s was North Africa, and I did all the rest of my operational flying on Spit 9s. It was, I think, the perfect one.
How effective were the Spitfires for strafing work?
Well, they were all right. I mean, I thought when we started using Spit 9s to strafe, and they were for high-flying fighters, it was a bit of a waste, but... You know, at the end of the campaign, we were doing. We don't suppose we did all that amount of strafing after the first few weeks because we were more used for, you know, take on the Luftwaffe.
Did you shoot anything down about Tunisia?
Yes. Can't remember now. I think 3109s and an 88. Actually, the 88 is quite interesting. Because before we got the 9s, as I told you, we were sleeping in this big tent. And what they did, the Germans, they used to send an 88 over at night, and he'd go round and round and drop one bomb about every 10 minutes. Well, the result was, you got no sleep. It was very crafty. Then another one would come and take over. So right through the night, you always knew there was going to be a bomb dropped. And one occasion, I was actually fed up with this, and it was not long before dawn, and myself and the other flight commander, we rushed out, and there were two going round. He took off, and eventually he shot it down on the circuit, but mine had disappeared. He'd gone off home. But of course, he was flying into the east, and I thought, well, if I get right on the deck, low down, with a bit of luck, I should see him against the coming dawn. Which is exactly what happened. I was all of a sudden I could just see this